Revolution is the stuff of extremists, people who know they're right about the issue at hand and will stop at nothing, not violence, not murder, to achieve drastic political or social change. Only amoral people advocate for revolution. It's for people who refuse to uphold the fundamentally human banner of cooperation, or at least compromise, and pursue a more reasonable goal. Revolution is for people who don't understand that change doesn't happen overnight. It's for attention seekers and wannabe despots. It's for people who act brashly and deny the virtues of logic and patience. Revolution does not provide long-term solutions. It's a thoughtless and unrefined way for zealots to wrest power from the hands of those who truly deserve it. Revolution is scary. It's dangerous. It does not work. Revolution is wrong. Revolution is for people who are unwilling to settle. It's for people who choose not to be silently subject to the exploitation of authorities with unchecked power. Revolution is really not that extreme when lives are at stake. It's for people whose justified rage has reached a tipping point. For people who rebel because complying has benefited others and harmed them. Revolution is the action of people who have realized that their silences will not protect them, as activist and writer Audre Lorde put it. It's for people who have hope, for those who are down to make sacrifices to ensure a better future. People who don't care to concede to lesser evils and pity-based handouts. Revolution is not for people who are arrogant and impulsive, but for those who are selfless and far-sighted. The heated emotions that incite revolution are not a fault, but a call to action and catalyst for significant shifts in thought and practice. Revolution is a response to problems so pervasive and so long-lasting that those who suffer recognize the need for disruption and upheaval. It's easy to criticize the means and end of revolution, and rightfully so. But what was the cause? I'm Eve Jeffcoat, and this is Unpopular, a show about people in history who did not let the threat of persecution keep them from speaking truth to power. Today, we'll take time to look at the life of Qiao Jin, who has been called the Chinese Joan of Arc for her defiance of gender norms, her revolutionary spirit, and her legendary status in China's history. But Qiao Jin's story is not Joan of Arc's story, nor is it necessary to downplay Qiao Jin's life and achievements by positioning her as a woman already famously mythologized in white history, modified by her nationality or ethnicity. If you can't tell already how much this kind of phrasing bothers me, then I'm telling you how much it bothers me, especially since it typically operates so that a figure who's already othered historically is left unnamed, relegated to the shadow of a person deemed more worthy of recognition or mythical status. Feelings aside, Qiao has mentioned Joan of Arc in her writing and drew inspiration from the stories of heroines in history. My point is, Qiao Jin's story is one that could have only taken place once Qiao Jin was born, which may have been on November 8, 1875, or could have been in the following years. It is known that Qiao Jin was born named Qiao Guajin during the Qing Dynasty in Xiamen, Fujie Province, China. She was part of a gentry family who were respected but declining. Her father was a lower-level civil servant, a job that required the family to pick up and move a lot in the 1880s and 1890s. Qiao's mom instilled in her a love for learning, providing Qiao with private teachers and books. Among the texts Qiao read were Confucian classics, texts about the French Revolution, Enlightenment works, and novels. But the political climate that Qiao lived in also provided her with a form of non-academic education and provided her with reason to challenge the Qing dynasty's rule. In Qiao's early years, China was nearing the end of its traditional period, and it was a hotbed of revolt and dramatic change. Missionaries and the Chinese were founding girls' schools, and some people were criticizing the practice of foot binding, a custom that symbolized status and beauty for girls and women in China. From the mid-18th century to the early 19th century, foreign nations like the British, French, Dutch, and Americans squeezed a lot of concessions out of the Chinese government and operated with impunity in the country. After the Opium War, more Chinese ports were opened for foreign trade. Foreigners were granted more travel in China. Foreigners were able to govern themselves in China. Valuable natural resources were taken out of China, and foreign nations could station warships and use military force for their economic interests in the country. Meanwhile, many Chinese people suffered from poverty and famine, and death tolls in war and social conflicts ran high. People like revolutionary Sun Yat-sen expressed their anger with the Qing dynasty through rebellion, reform, and revolution. Cho's family's appreciation for poetry also influenced her, as Cho began writing poetry when she was a child. And it was an art form she used throughout her life to express her personal feelings, as well as her political beliefs and aspirations. Xianyu, or talented women, contributed a lot to literature and were admired in Chinese history. And by the late imperial era, they were exploring new methods of expression. Many elite women wanted the label of Xianyu. When Cho was young, she wrote poems and lyrics, or si, on subjects that women poets had traditionally written about throughout Chinese history, like flowers, solitude, friendship, and domestic activities. Cho's feet were most likely bound, as was customary for young girls of many social classes in the Qing period, though they may not have been bound that tightly. Still, Cho began training in the martial arts early on. She enjoyed riding horses and brandishing swords. She studied Chinese martial folk heroines like Hua Mulan, whom Cho viewed as a role model, and she began to think of herself as a knight errant who could save her country from the plague of foreign domination. In her early poems on women heroes, she critiques the accepted social order that said women were inferior to men. In one series of poems she wrote, titled On Zhe Kan Ji, she wrote this. Banished into this dusty world, what a shame to be a man. Shouldering dagger axes, young beauties became generals. Now the names of the loyal and filial belong to women. History forever speaks shame of Zhuo Ningnan. Zhuo Ningnan, or Zhuo Longyu, was a Ming Dynasty general who was executed. In 1896, her father arranged her marriage to Wang Tingzhi, the son of a wealthy merchant and philanthropist, and the couple eventually had two children together. But Wang spent a lot of time gambling and in brothels. He was described in contemporary accounts as a talentless and cowardly guy, and Qiao Jin was not happy in her marriage. Her desire to become a famous poet faltered. She described this distress in her poetry. Alas, they sent me off by force to be mere rouge and powder. How I despise it, she wrote. But while she was in this unhappy marriage, she continued to dream of better times for China and denounced the intrusion of foreigners. When the family moved to Beijing in the early 1900s, in the wake of the Boxer Rebellion and anti-foreign and anti-Christian uprising, Cho met other women who were concerned about the socio-political climate in China. She became close with calligrapher Wu Ziying, and she delved deeper into ideas of women's liberation, democracy, and revolution. She read the works of Liang Cixiao, a scholar and reformist who said that the modern education of women in China should not be impractical, but should be Western and politically conscious, as that was what would help build a stronger nation. He and other writers calling for women's emancipation still confined women to roles as good wives and good mothers, and relied on the workings of patriarchy, just under the guise of nationalism. Wrestling with her longing to serve her country and expectations for her to serve as a mother and wife, she wrote this in a poem. War flames in the north. When will it all end? I hear the fighting at sea continues unabated. Like the woman of Qixia, I worry about my country in vain. It's hard to trade kerchief and dress for a helmet. In 1904, Cho's disdain for her family life and her yearning for education, as well as social and political change in China, led her to move to Japan, where many Chinese intellectuals and reformers were moving at the time. She sold her jewelry to fund the trip and hopped on a boat from Tianjin to Japan, leaving her son, daughter, and husband behind. Pretty soon, for Cho, the patriarchal family structure would come to signify women's oppression, and education, women's emancipation, and revolution would take front and center in her life. We're going to take a quick break, but when we get back, we'll trace Cho Jin's transformation into a revolutionary. In situations where there's a lot of social or political division or conflict, when people are rebelling against the status quo, many people will call for civility or respectability. Recent calls for civility in the U.S. often reinforce an intentionally oppressive standard of appropriateness that makes people who are challenging a system look like unruly agitators who are unworthy of support. They require a person to water down or silence their dissent in favor of a method that has likely been used in the past and proved largely fruitless. So many people decry this kind of policing, as it implies that people must maintain the status quo in order to be respected and heard. People calling for civility are often not just calling for politeness. They are saying in so many words that it is inappropriate for those who are speaking up to express themselves in any way that they deem unacceptable. In the U.S., the word civility can bring to mind histories of cultural assimilation, discrimination and destruction, classism and racism, and political manipulation. And around the world, calls for order, tolerance, cultures of coerced silence, and strict regulation of protest limit the effectiveness of challenges to the status quo. A figure people like to bring up often for his civil disobedience and calls for peace and cooperation is Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Neither King's intellect, nor his wide-ranging appeal, nor his respectability saved him from being assassinated when he was just 39 years old. Uncivil or well-mannered, either can be dangerous when a person who has radical ideas opposes or defies an established order. Sun and moon have no more light. Earth is dark. Our woman's world has sunk so deep. Who can help us? Jewelry sold to pay for this trip across the seas. Cut off from my family, I leave my native land. Unbinding my feet, I clean out 1,000 years of poison. With hot heart, arouse all women's spirits. Alas, this delicate kerchief here is half stained with blood and half with tears. Those are Cho's words from her poem called Regrets, Lines Written en Route to Japan. When Cho got to Japan, she changed her name from Cho Gui Jin to just Cho Jin, removing the Gui, which meant boudoir, and also was used to refer to daughters and women in the inner chambers. She began attending a Japanese language school in Tokyo and later went to a vocational school that offered a teacher training program for Chinese women. She frequently cross-dressed, a practice that some have said she did for attention for herself and her revolutionary efforts, but that was also the embodiment of her feelings of freedom and gender expression and defiance of the role Chinese tradition had prescribed women. Feminist activism in Japan had taken root, with people like Fukuda Hideko leading the charge. In Japan, Cho found a community that promoted radical thinking. She gave lectures on the oppression of women under patriarchy and the oppression of the Chinese people under Manchu rule, able to appeal to more women, including those who could not read, through public speaking. China was failing, she said, subject to the whims of foreign nations and to Manchu misrule, and it was women's duty to lift themselves out of oppression and ignorance to save the nation and establish a new republic. She said in a lecture addressed to Chinese women, "Dear listeners, do you realize that our nation is about to perish? Men cannot be sure of their own survival, so how can we continue to rely on them? If we do not lift ourselves up now, it will truly be too late once the nation has perished." Cho also learned to make bombs, practice fencing and marksmanship, and she began writing journalistic pieces. She became involved in anti-Manchu secret societies like the Restoration Society and the Revolutionary Alliance. The Manchus were the ethnic group that ruled in the Qing Dynasty. Cho founded the Baihua Bao, or vernacular journal, in which she published articles in support of women's education and in opposition to foot-binding and the patriarchal system that kept women powerless. Cho advocated for publishing her work in a common Chinese vernacular that was easy to understand, as many people in China did not have access to much education. Through the journal, she sought to encourage revolution. In 1905, Cho returned to China briefly, where she linked up with her cousin, Xi Xilin, who was also involved in anti-Qing organizations. But she did go back to Japan for a little while, where she completed her teacher training course, did military drills and target practice, and protested the Japanese government along with other Chinese students, as the government had been pressured by the Qing dynasty to shut down the revolutionary activity of Chinese students in Japan. Activist and writer Chen Tianhua drowned himself in protest of the regulations that the Japanese Ministry of Education had imposed, an act that had a profound effect on Cho. She decided to take Chen's advice and go back to China to fight against the Qing dynasty. She wrote in a poem on her way back to China, "There is no wine that can dissolve my sorrow for the nation. The current crisis demands persons of extraordinary talents. Even if it takes the blood of hundreds of thousands of people, we will have to turn the whole world around by our efforts." We're going to pause here for a quick break. And when we return, we'll look at Cho's last days in her home country. Cho returned to China for good in late 1905 or early 1906. There, she published the short-lived Chinese Women's Journal, for which she wrote more vernacular articles exhorting women to fight for their freedom and save China from the Manchu government. She taught in a girls' school, encouraging other teachers to become politically active and take up the causes of nationalism and women's emancipation. After the Chinese government encouraged the creation of schools teaching traditional and modern subjects, Xi Xilin founded a school for young women called the Datong Normal School in Shaoxing, Zhejiang Province, which was really a headquarters for training revolutionaries. In February of 1907, when Xi Xilin left for the Anhui Province to lead the police academy, she became director of the school. As Cho led the revolutionaries and military drills at the school, she also connected many revolutionary organizations and recruited activists to join the anti-Manchu fight. Cho and Xi Xilin began planning an uprising against the dynasty, scheduled for July. But authorities quickly got word that a rebellion would happen soon. In early July, Xi Xilin was executed after murdering the governor of Anhui Province, An Ming, who was a Manchu. Cho learned of his death days later in a newspaper, but she refused to flee to safety. When she found out troops were being sent to Datong School, she told teachers and students to hide themselves and their weapons. Still, she stayed at the school. Only a week after Xi Xilin died, a Qing militia unit arrested Cho and other revolutionaries, interrogated her about her anti-Qing activities, and tortured her. She refused to give up any info or confess, but the authorities gathered evidence of her revolutionary thought and activities, including her writing, as proof of her criminality. She was beheaded on July 15, 1907. Exactly what crime she was accused of is unclear, but it was judged to be punishable as treason. She was buried and moved a couple of times before her remains were buried in their final location, near Westlake in Hangzhou. Despite Cho's death, anti-Qing sentiment was still strong in China. Other revolutionaries continued the work of overthrowing the government. In 1912, the last emperor of China, Pu Yi, was forced to abdicate the throne, though this did not in any way rid the country of political turmoil. In that same year, the new government banned foot-binding, though the ban wasn't wholly enforced and the practice continued in some areas of China. Some critics say her belief in her ability to drastically change Chinese society and politics by overthrowing the Qing dynasty was foolish and bright-eyed. Some consider her death a pointless sacrifice and that she could have saved herself. Some view her as a martyr who was not afraid to put her life on the line to secure the future of China and ensure women's liberation. Cho's friend, Wu Ziying, wrote the following about Cho after her death. Although this lady scholar was always fond of acting impulsively, she did not die because she was a criminal. The officials may have been violent and rapacious, but they would not have gone to such cruel lengths. It must be that there was someone who held a private grudge against her and plotted her downfall by availing himself of this case against some revolutionaries in order to ingratiate himself with his superiors. So it is not just the officials who are to be blamed. Alas, and this is called the period of preparation for constitutional government. Revolutions and revolutionaries are not always bastions of moral decency and collective progress. Revolutions can be carried out in service of racist, classist, and prejudiced causes and perpetuate abuses that they did not seek to abolish. Just because someone or some group is fighting for revolution for a cause they believe is moral does not mean it is without fault or universally just. Attempts at revolution are not guaranteed to succeed, and the outcome of revolution is not predictable or guaranteed to meet expectations. As with any other attempt to change established values, procedures, people, and institutions, the effects of revolution are pliable and require constant attention and care. The Manchu suppression of Han culture and anti-Manchu sentiment fueled rebellion and eventual revolution. Revolution is not as cut and dry as a victory of the good over the bad, the right over the wrong. Qiao Jin's influences and ideals were also complex. She championed issues of women's liberation, challenged the boundaries and expectations of gender, and opposed Western imperialism and Qing rulership while promoting a Western-style constitutional government. In her writing, full of allusions to stories in world history and evidence of her struggle in parsing her gender expression and gender norms, showed just how heavily the issues of the world weighed on her and how she believed change was necessary to end suffering. So she worked with conviction in trying to advance Chinese women's rights and tearing down an incompetent, cruel, and illegitimate government. For that, her writings and, well, the mythologizing of the circumstances of her execution, Qiao's life is amplified in Chinese and, to a lesser extent, world history. There is no master moral compass or crystal ball that can tell us whether our revolutionary goals are right in the grand scheme of history. We can look to Qiao Jin's story for guidance in using meaningful education and analysis, language, and direct action to envision and implement thoughtful change that once seemed impossible. To be a revolutionary is to wade into uncharted waters with no life jacket. But when the place you're leaving behind is a place of gratuitous personal and societal hardship, the expanse ahead seems more promising than frightening. We'll see you again next week with another episode of Unpopular. Our producer is Andrew Howard. Holly Fry and Christopher Hasiotis are our executive producers, and you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, the iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.